Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Between 1890 and 1930, the proportion of American men who were unmarried was greater than at any time in the nation's history. They gathered in cities and they created a new and fascinating lifestyle. In a moment, we'll take a look at that lifestyle and the bachelor culture they created, the effects of which are still with us today. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1957, the Soviet Union officially began the space age with its launch of Sputnik 1, the world's first Earth-orbiting man-made satellite. While this feat was a triumph for the communist world, it resulted in pangs of hysteria and urgency for the West. The Soviet government gave fair warning concerning its intentions and interest in space exploration, but much of the free world took the Soviets' words as nothing more than propaganda. The result was a race that lasted until the fall of the Iron Curtain, man's landing on the moon, and exploration of the far reaches of space. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, in Brazil, many Catholics and non-Catholics alike are mourning the passing of Archbishop Helder Câmara, an early advocate of liberation theology and an outspoken critic of the military dictatorships that ruled his homeland in the 1970s and 80s. Archbishop Câmara found the Catholic Church too hierarchical and conservative to address the many human problems faced by the poor. He embraced liberation theology, which emphasizes a concern for human problems in this world, as opposed to dwelling on the fruits of the afterlife. Because of his theology, he was thought of as a communist by many of his own people, and in 1969, he was the object of a failed assassination attempt. Câmara nevertheless held steadfast to his beliefs, once retorting, "When I fed the poor, they called me a saint. When I asked, why are they poor, they called me a communist." Residents of Americana, Brazil continue to fly the Confederate flag over 100 years after the defeat of the Confederacy. That's because residents known as Confederados in Latin America are descendants of the many Southerners who abandoned the United States for Brazil after the Civil War. Their ancestors were lured to Brazil, the largest nation in South America, by the urging of Emperor Dom Pedro II, who envisioned them bringing their cotton exports to his country. While many critics in the U.S. and Brazil believe that the flag still represents racism and hatred, this unique community of Americans begs to differ. According to one descendant, "That flag to me means the good memories and good habits cultivated and inherited from my ancestors. It's got nothing to do with racism and outlaws." You're listening to Talking History. At the end of the 19th century, single men migrated to American cities in large numbers, and in the process, they created a subculture about which we used to know very little, even though the effects of that subculture can still be seen today. A fascinating part of our history brought alive in an excellent new book titled The Age of the Bachelor, Creating an American Subculture, published by Princeton University Press. Its author, Howard Chudikoff, professor of history, joins us today from Brown University. Welcome, Howard, and thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Congratulations on The Age of the Bachelor.
Thank you very much.
Howard, what led to the migration of so many bachelors to American cities in the late 19th century?
Well, the late 19th century was a time of great social and economic change. The rise of industrialization, the opening up of new occupations, and a general sense of independence that was pervading the youth of America, I think, attracted people especially to cities.
Was there an overall increase in the number of bachelors or proportion of bachelors in the general population, or was it just that they concentrated in the cities?
The numbers of bachelors certainly increased, and probably a little bit faster than the general population. It's kind of hard to measure what proportion they were in cities because the census reports and other kinds of data were not as full as they became right around the turn of the century. So we don't know exactly how many bachelors there were or what the proportions were until around the 1880s and 1890s, but it appears that there was a rise in the certainly the numbers and probably the proportions too.
What kind of culture, lifestyle, whatever you want to call it, did these urban bachelors create for themselves?
There were districts in particular cities where there were large numbers of rooming houses and boarding houses where bachelors lived, and they created a subculture for themselves also in the saloons, the pool halls, the meeting rooms like the YMCA, barber shops, amusement parks, dance halls, places like that where they hung out. It's important to remember also, however, that about half of those men who were adult and unmarried in the cities still lived at home with some member of a family, but they were like boarders in their own homes because they had lives and independence of their own.
Describe these boarding houses. Was this a new phenomenon in that time period?
No, boarding houses and kind of residential hotels for transient, young, unattached people had existed in cities from the very beginning. But as a fuller institution, one that became important to the lifestyles of young, unmarried people, the boarding houses of the late 19th century were in some senses new because there were so many more of them.
They would have single rooms, sleeping rooms, maybe a common parlor. Did they take their meals there?
Yes, the difference between a boarding house and a lodging house is that in a boarding house, meals were provided. There were usually single rooms, but sometimes men doubled up as roommates in a particular apartment. But lodging houses were more of a single rooms for people, and they did not supply meals.
Was there a disproportionate representation in terms of social class or ethnicity among these urban bachelors?
Primarily they were working class, but there were middle class and even some upper class boarding houses as well. I found evidence of some quite fashionable apartment houses and boarding houses for wealthier men, but usually the boarding house districts of cities were filled with working class and lower middle class men, the men who worked in the accounting houses and as clerks, as well as those who worked on the docks and in the factories.
You mentioned pool halls and saloons. What other kinds of entertainment did these urban bachelors have at the turn of the century?
They went to parks, amusement parks, dance halls, and sporting events. Most of the time, though, they were out hanging out with each other. They went to the common rooms in the boarding houses. They went to the YMCA and other kinds of organizations like that. So they had fairly full leisure time activities.
Were these forms of entertainment available when they moved into the city, or were they created in response to their presence, sort of market-driven?
It's almost a chicken and egg proposition. It's kind of hard to say which came first. It was more of a symbiotic situation, I think, that some of these amusements, of course, had existed, and then entrepreneurs who saw that there was a clientele for them were eager to make money and provide these kinds of services so that they operated these things in response to the rise of bachelors. And then the more attractions there were, then the more bachelors used them. And so it was kind of a spiraling process.
And how would this differ from the life of an urban married man?
An urban married man was more home-oriented in his activities. Certainly married men did leave the family and the household to be involved in organizational activities, and they too frequented the saloons and pool halls. But their leisure time, their non-work time, was filled much more with family activities than it was for single men.
Now, whether it was perceived or reality, and you can comment on that, the life of the urban bachelor seems to have been somewhat alarming to married men and women or non-urban types, because the institution of marriage itself was almost sacred in the United States at the time. Did you see
Absolutely.
Much of this?
The unmarried male particularly has generally been a pariah throughout history because he lacked that kind of anchor to his life, the responsibilities and the mutuality of family life. So being unattached and being young, particularly, and at a time of life when men are prone not only to challenging authority and to trying to push the boundaries of their behavior, but also prone to violent behavior, men who were unmarried were often feared and reviled in cities. Yet I think for the most part, this applied to the actual men who were doing these things were only a minority. Most of them were just minding their own business.
Now, along this line in your book, you talk about gay life or homosexual activity among these urban bachelors. What did you find there?
Well, certainly there was a component of bachelor society that included homosexual men. It's difficult to some extent to uncover everything that was going on and what their activities were because, of course, this was a status of life that was oftentimes persecuted legally and not so. But gay men had their own subculture that was a part of bachelor subculture. They had their own saloons and cafes and organizations and dance halls and bathhouses and the rest that a number of historians have just begun to find out more about.
Did you find a parallel development among single women, perhaps a single woman's urban culture?
A very interesting question. Since my research focused only on men, I didn't really do much with regard to women. But I would point out that the trend in the rise and then later decline in the number of unmarried men in American cities was followed in the same way by women. That is, periods when there were high proportions of unmarried men in American society, there were also high proportions of unmarried women. And when those proportions declined among men, they declined among women. The difference being that the proportions of women who were unmarried were not as high as those of men, because women generally get married 2 or 3 years earlier than men do.
Were the informal social institutions more restrictive, perhaps, on women at the turn of the century than they were on men? Or, again, didn't you study that in your...
Oh, yes, definitely. It would be very unseemly for a woman, even a couple of women who were unmarried, to go into a saloon alone. They generally had to be escorted to dance halls, although not always. There were other ways in which society frowned upon independent activity of women when they did not frown upon it when it was done by men.
In your book, you suggest that this urban bachelor culture at the turn of the century affected and maybe even continues to affect our definition today of manhood and manliness. Explain that for us.
Well, I believe that the large numbers and large proportions of unmarried men who frequented cities around the turn of the century influenced the general culture in a way that continued even after their numbers and proportions declined in the first half of the 20th century. A lot of the so-called bad habits that were ascribed to bachelors at that particular time actually became more acceptable by the time you get to the 1920s and 1930s. I'm talking about habits of drinking, smoking, and even cursing, which, of course, still were frowned upon, but the tolerance of society was broken down somewhat. And I think it, in many ways it was because the bachelor society was influential.
was this totally broken down, or was it segmented in such a way that it was considered to be perhaps a stage of life for men who would then go into marriage and abandon these ways?
Yes, I think that's true, because marriage was supposed to tame these men who were sowing their wild oats. Nevertheless, there was a residual in that there was a kind of component of bachelor subculture that men carried with them even after they married.
There's been an increase in the number of single men and women in the United States in the last 20 years or so. Do you see any comparable cultural changes that relate to what you found at the turn of the century?
To some extent, I do. Between about 1910 and 1960, there was a decline in the numbers and proportions of bachelors, and since 1960, that proportion has risen again. In fact, the average age at first marriage of men in the 1990s has exceeded the peak that had existed in the 1890s. And there are parallels, because the single society today has institutions that resemble those of previous years in terms of singles bars, health clubs, organizations, and that sort of thing. The difference is, however, that today much more of these institutions are what we might call heterosocial. That is, they include men and women, whereas in the 100 years ago, these institutions were more homosocial. There were more institutions and establishments exclusively for men and exclusively for women.
Interesting. Well, I have time only for one last question, and I also found this interesting in your book that you talked about the decline of bachelorhood, for lack of a better word, between the 1930s and the 1970s. And yet, we tend to look at the 1950s as a baseline for anything that we measure in terms of marriage and the family. And yet, by this, you're suggesting that this may have been rather unique rather than the norm. You want to comment on that?
I guess what I could say is that the 1950s being the time of the peak of the baby boom, and you can't have a baby boom without having a marriage boom, was a unique period in our history when people were marrying at much younger ages than they ever had in the past, and therefore having more time to have children. So because of these demographic factors, I think that period was somewhat unique. The 30s and 40s were times at which marriage was being postponed by men and women, but they were marrying somewhat of a more rapid rate than they were in the 1890s. But I think the fact that we've returned to a society in which there are large numbers and proportions of single people really shows that not only marriage is a normal state for human society, but also the unmarried state, at least for temporarily, for a short period of people's lives, is also a normal state. The difference being today, though, that people are still pairing up. Throughout the past, most of the people who were unmarried eventually did get married. And today, a large component of the singles population includes men and women who are living together in quasi-marital situations, but are not counted as married by the census because they're not formally married.
Great. Good corrective, and a nice point to end on.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. We really enjoyed it. And again, congratulations on your book.
Thank you, Ken.
You've been listening to Professor Howard Chudikoff of Brown University and the author of The Age of the Bachelor, Creating an American Subculture, published by Princeton University Press. And this is Talking History. For the past three decades, leading American public figures have raised their voices in a steady chorus of calls for campaign finance reform.
Those voices, however, have been met with powerful resistance from political leaders and even the United States Supreme Court, who have argued that political spending is a form of political speech, which, like all speech in a democratic society, should remain free from governmental control. Here to discuss the history of these opposing points of view is historian Robert Much, author of Campaigns, Congress, and Courts, A Political History of Federal Campaign Finance Law.
Is political spending the same thing as political speech? The Supreme Court says it is, and it used this argument to weaken the campaign finance reforms passed after Watergate. One of the justices even coined the shorthand phrase by which this argument is now known, money is speech. It's been a favorite of campaign finance reform opponents ever since. Their claim is that limiting political spending limits political speech. For example, Tom Bellay, the House Republican whip, claims that the Shays-Meehan bill, the reform bill that's now stalled in the House, quote, threatens the First Amendment and political participation in the American political process, close quote. He's wrong. The real threat to participation is from the money is speech argument itself. Its very premise implies severe limits on effective citizenship. Think about it. If money really is speech, it follows that the rich have greater capacity for speech than the rest of us. In a democracy, speech is even more important than voting. Only through unfettered discussion can citizens cast informed votes. By implying that the rich are better than the rest of us at this most important of political activities, the money is speech argument links citizenship to property in a way that has long been outside the mainstream of American democratic thinking. The belief that those with property had more capability for citizenship than those without it was widely held in the 17th and 18th centuries. In those days, people without property were employed by, in debt to, or in more subtle ways dependent on property owners. That fact gave some validity to the argument that giving landless people the vote would only make them the political appendages of their landlords and creditors. By the mid-19th century, though, landless people gradually were getting the vote. Among the many who weren't entirely happy with this trend was the noted Democratic theorist John Stuart Mill. He acknowledged that every citizen had a claim to a voice, but that every citizen should have an equal voice was another matter. But how to decide how much voice a citizen should have? By Mill's time, the Industrial Revolution had undermined property ownership as the means for making that decision. So Mill updated property-based politics by proposing a sliding scale of citizenship based on what he called mental superiority. He proposed giving plural votes to employers, bankers, merchants, manufacturers, and others whose opinion, he claimed, was entitled to greater weight. Society has changed even more rapidly since Mill's time. Today there is broad agreement that all citizens should have an equal voice. The argument for inequality still thrives, though, because it is updated continually to keep pace with the times. The claim that money is speech is but the latest version of a very old argument. The money-speech equation is a shrewd strategic move because it disguises money's link to power by attaching it instead to the most widely revered part of our Constitution, the First Amendment. It makes the argument appear to be about defending everyone's right to free speech, when what it's really about is protecting wealth's claim to a larger voice. It's a brilliant updating of property-based politics.
You've been listening to Robert Much, author of Campaigns, Congress, and Courts, A Political History of Federal Campaign Finance. Much's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. October is the month for fall foliage. Lovely, colorful trees that create a natural tapestry we sometimes travel hundreds of miles and spend hours and even days admiring. Well, how about adding some history to your fall foliage excursion? Here is Talking History Cindy Workman, who, for our historic site of the week, will tell you where you can combine both.
Portsmouth, New Hampshire has a commitment to history. Near the waterfront is a 10-acre living history museum where 300 years of Portsmouth history play out every day. Strawberry Bank, named after the wild fruit that grew in the area when the settlers arrived and made it the third British settlement in the New World, has 40 preserved buildings that illustrate various aspects of Portsmouth history. Guides dressed in period dress, role play, and there are horse-drawn carriage rides as well. Strawberry Bank is open from April to the beginning of November, and there are also some historic houses dotting the small city if you would prefer that kind of tour, with plenty of restaurants and such along the way to quench any appetite.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, the History Channel has a lengthy list of interesting programs on its schedule for the next few weeks. If you're into spies, try the OSS, Origins of the CIA, on October 10th. Or on October 17th, Stalin Spies, a look at an elite group of secret agents Joseph Stalin sent to the West during World War II. As part of its Military Blunders series, the History Channel will premiere The Bay of Pigs and Disaster at Dien Bien Phu on October 17th. For something a little lighter, try Sell and Spin, a history of advertising, on October 15th. And finally, on October 18th, on PBS, there's Citizen Kurchatov, the story of Igor Kurchatov, the leading Soviet scientist responsible for developing that country's atomic bomb. As always, be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our final Columbus Day show of the millennium. Appropriately, we will look at the great explorer's millennial beliefs. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions by email to talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.